Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 4th. Drop in crashes. Midland traffic down 20% in 2020. Motran says drop in traffic volume, other statistics likely to be short-term. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. Traffic in Midland fell about 20% in 2020 compared to the previous year as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, according to the Midland Police Department's annual traffic crash report. Quote, due to the combination of effects from the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic slowdown in the oil and gas industry, traffic volumes decreased significantly in 2020, a spokesperson for the City of Midland said in a press release. Less traffic led to a drop in crashes and traffic fatalities, according to the report. Crashes were down nearly 40% compared to 2019, and the number of fatalities dropped from 17 to 12. However, that downward traffic trend is unlikely to last, according to James Beecham, president of the Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance. Quote, based on the factors that we track, for the most part, we expect it to be a very short-term decrease, he said in an interview Wednesday. The factors that Motran often uses to predict traffic patterns, like population growth and oil and gas activity, increased or remained almost constant in 2020, he said. So, without the coronavirus pandemic, traffic would have likely increased too. Beecham said the population of Midland rose by about 2,400 last year, and while there was some decrease in oil production, gas production saw a massive increase. Oil prices are also on the rebound after going negative early in 2020, now staying above $50 a barrel. Quote, I predict traffic will pick up in 2021, Beecham said. Something that didn't change in 2020 was the most dangerous intersections in Midland. The Loop 250 intersections at Andrews Highway, Thomason Drive, and Big Spring Street were the most common crash sites last year and in 2019, according to the Midland Police Department report. The report shows that drops in traffic appear to coincide with business shutdowns and high coronavirus cases. The months with the lowest numbers of accidents reported were April and July, which each had 146 crashes reported. There were 358 accidents reported in January, the most in 2020. Of the 12 traffic fatalities in 2020, three of the crashes were alcohol or drug-related, according to the report. The youngest person involved in a fatal accident last year was an 11-year-old girl who died on February 7th. The report shows that the three busiest intersections in 2020 were Andrews Highway and Midland Drive, Andrews Highway and Midkiff Road, and Wadley Avenue and Midkiff Road. Midland Independent School District experiences same drop-off in COVID cases. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD is reporting a similar decline in COVID cases that is being seen across the community. The district, on its website, is showing three straight weeks of falling weekly case totals, from 119 just after the return from winter break to 36 coming during the week of January 25th. The City of Midland and Midland Health are showing similar drops in positive tests and confirmed cases during the month of January. Midland ISD Chief of Staff Katie Atkins said during a recent United Command press conference that district leaders, quote, strongly encourage everyone to practice mitigation efforts, including wearing masks, practicing social distancing, and washing hands to make sure that those numbers stay low, end quote. The district, she said, also was working to make vaccines available to school nurses and employees in high-risk groups. Even this week, Midland ISD reported that, quote, MISD staff had the opportunity to receive vaccines when it became apparent that there were a number of no-shows at the Horseshoe. Preference was given to those who met the 1A or 1B criteria. MISD continues to work in collaboration with MMH regarding COVID-19 vaccination, and we are thankful for those doses that have been made available to our staff, end quote. The district reported 294 confirmed cases during the month of January and 1,358 since the district started to keep track of cases in June. The spike in cases appeared to take place in November, as there were 406 cases reported during the first four full weeks of the month. That number dropped to 333 in December and 279 in January. The campuses with the most confirmed cases reported are Midland High and Lee High School, with 206 and 185 cases respectively. San Jacinto and Goddard have had the most at the junior high level, 67 and 59 cases respectively, while Washington STEM Academy and Fasken have recorded the most cases of the elementary schools, 32 each. Idea Travis is showing the fewest cases of the elementary or secondary. A study says New Mexico could lose billions under federal oil and gas leasing ban. The story was written by Adrian Hedden with the Carlsbad Current Argus newspaper in New Mexico. President Joe Biden's actions to halt new oil and gas leasing on federal land could put more than $1 billion in New Mexico's revenue at risk, argued the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, NMOGA, a trade group representing fossil fuel companies throughout the state. Last week, Biden signed an executive order to temporarily, but without a specified time frame, block oil companies from acquiring any new leases on federal land. The initiative was meant to address environmental concerns and mitigate the industry's impact on pollution and climate change, and allow for the federal government to review such impacts and seek stricter regulations. But leaders, both in New Mexico politics and from the industry, quickly condemned the move as potentially devastating the economy of a state that relies heavily on extraction for its bottom line. An analysis released Tuesday by NMOGA and conducted by the New Mexico Tax Research Institute showed oil and gas production on federal land accounted for $2 billion in state and local revenue and 18% of total state spending in fiscal year 2020. Local revenue was about $163 million, and state revenue was $1.8 million, including $1.5 billion to New Mexico's general fund. Operations on federal lands was credited with about 54% of the $2.8 billion the industry contributed to state revenue, the report said. NMOGA President Ryan Flynn said limiting production on federal land would disrupt oil and gas production in New Mexico and could risk its economic benefit to the state. Quote, oil and gas development on federal lands is and will be a critical part of New Mexico's economic and fiscal future, Flynn said. Our ability to develop resources on federal lands has a direct impact on the future of our state and the level of investment we're able to provide in critical areas like education, healthcare, and public safety, end quote. The ban could create a regulatory environment, Flynn said, that oil companies could view as unfavorable to their business models. That could mean oil and gas producers could move operations into neighboring Texas, where most operations occur on private land, unimpacted by federal policy. Less production in New Mexico and domestically could mean more imports of fossil fuels from foreign countries like Saudi Arabia or Russia, Flynn argued, which he said have less stringent environmental regulations. Quote, policies like a federal leasing ban only threaten to upend our economy and keeping energy jobs and development here at home rather than outsourcing them abroad has an enormous ripple effect on the entire state, he said. Continuing the quote, New Mexicans want to work, and those who work in this industry want to continue the safe and responsible energy production that our state depends upon, end quote. Flynn said the industry supported the Biden administration's desire to address its carbon footprint and impact on the environment, but contended that such efforts must be driven by the industry itself instead of blanket regulations from the federal government. Quote, we share the new administration's priority to reduce emissions and combat climate change, but we must do so with an inclusive approach that doesn't put jobs, communities, and states like New Mexico on the chopping block, Flynn said. We are ready to work together to identify solutions and policies that ensure energy jobs stay in New Mexico and essential funding for teachers and first responders is not eliminated, end quote. But the Department of the Interior, the federal agency Biden's order called on to impose the halt on leasing, pointed to millions of acres stockpiled by the oil and gas industry on federal lands and waters that could sustain operations during the pause, per a release following the announcement of the order. Onshore, the department reported more than 26 million acres were under federal lease to the industry, and about 53%, or 13.9 million acres, were unused and not producing oil or gas. The industry also held up more than 9.3 million unused offshore acres, of 77% of its 12 million leased acres. About 7,700 approved permits to drill were unused, the DOI reported, both onshore and offshore. The ban on new leases was part of Biden's efforts to reverse former President Donald Trump's pro-fossil fuels agenda, the release said, which constituted a fire sale of public land to the industry. Quote, the president's action will provide a chance to review the federal oil and gas program to ensure that it serves the public interest and to restore balance on America's public lands and waters to benefit current and future generations, read the DOI statement. Quote, irresponsible leasing of public lands and waters impacts communities' access to clean air, clean water, and outdoor recreation, carves up important wildlife habitat, and threatens cultural and sacred sites, end quote. New Mexico's Republican Party, a frequent supporter of oil and gas, called on Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and the state's congressional delegation to publicly oppose the executive order and demand the president reverse course. The party issued a statewide petition on Tuesday and distributed to constituents via email and on social media. Lujan Grisham indicated following the announcement that her office was reviewing what impact Biden's order would have on the state. She did not state if she would seek an exemption, but vowed to work with the president to develop a, quote, balanced national policy for energy and action on climate change. Quote, the governor cannot roll over and watch New Mexico suffer even more, said Nick Curran, executive director of the Republican Party of New Mexico. Quote, RPNM believes it's imperative the governor demonstrate her support and commitment to this critical industry by taking suitable action to protect her state and its constituents, end quote.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing with Inside Stories from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Thursday, February 4th. Artworks Midland creates new mural with youth from community, by J.C. Lewis. A new mural popped up last weekend in Old Town Midland. The project was completed by Artworks Midland with the Youth Art Project, according to a Facebook post, and is located on Pool Techniques Incorporated's wall. The company also funded the project at its location at 2514 West Ohio Avenue. The organization is trying to paint positive quote murals throughout the city and inspire youth to be positive and create. Artworks Midland is also looking to create another mural of the City of Midland with the Youth Art Project at the Fafa Gallery. The organization is currently looking for sponsors to help fund the mural. Sponsors will have their name or logo added to the mural. Those interested in sponsoring can call 556-0150 or 212-8104. Artworks Midland also will host a live rooftop art show on February 20th. The event will start at 6 p.m. and last until 11 p.m. at the Doubletree by Hilton Midland Plaza. Live arts, live music, and drinks will be available. There is a $10 cover charge. Midland on list of CVS sites administering vaccines, by Priscilla Aguirre, Hearst Newspapers. COVID-19 vaccines are coming to CVS pharmacies in Texas, but only 70 locations will roll them out starting February 11th. CVS Health announced the incoming vaccines are part of an 11-state rollout across approximately 335 CVS pharmacy locations, according to a Tuesday news release from CVS. Supply for the limited rollout in the state, which is sourced directly from the Federal Pharmacy Partnership Program, will be approximately 38,000 doses. Participating CVS pharmacies are in communities throughout Texas, including Abilene, Amarillo, Beaumont, Brownsville, El Paso, Houston, Laredo, Lubbock, Midland, Plano, San Antonio, and Waco, the release noted. Vaccines at participating CVS pharmacy locations in Texas will be available to individuals meeting state criteria, the release noted. In Texas, frontline healthcare workers and residents at long-term care facilities, called Phase 1A, as well as people over 65 or over 16 with a chronic medical condition that puts them at an increased risk for severe illness from COVID-19, called Phase 1B, are currently eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Participants must register in advance at CVS.com or through the CVS Pharmacy app. And people without online access can contact CVS customer service at 800-746-7287. That's 800-746-7287. Appointments will become available for booking as early as February 9th, the release stated. Walk-in vaccinations without an appointment will not be provided. The list of specific stores will be available on CVS.com as stores receive shipments of vaccine and appointments become available. As more supply becomes available, the company will expand to more locations and offer additional appointments. Midland Reporter-Telegram opinion page, Thursday, February 4th. Opinion extras. Midland's next leader of schools faces an awesome opportunity. Welcome to Midland, Angelica Ramsey. Friday is the day the Midland ISD is expected to approve your contract, making you the 12th permanent superintendent in the history of the district. We are waiting to see a copy of the contract, but it is expected that your salary will be the same as the person who previously held the position. I have to admit that I thought Midland ISD's next leader would demand a higher salary, considering the challenge that awaits. However, from what I understand, you are full of surprises. When asked what computer setup you wanted, you said that you want whatever teachers have. Even asked a second time about mobile devices and other perks of the office, you repeated your request. If it is good enough for the person on education's front line, it is good enough for you. I look forward to meeting you face to face because at this point you seem too good to be true. My guess is there are thousands of people like me. They'll want confirmation that you are the real thing. No, check that. They'll want confirmation you are the right person to lead public education in Midland. A little warning, there are going to be people who question the idea of bringing someone in from California. They believe everyone from California worships at the altar of Nancy Pelosi and takes their cues from Hollywood. They miss the part of your story where you said, "I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I didn't like living in the Bay Area." They don't understand that someone can be excited about a move from the Golden State to the Permian Basin because it's like we're getting back to real people that you can be real with. Dr. Ramsey, Midlanders will be skeptical. It doesn't matter that your previous board president told the Reporter-Telegram that one of your great legacies was your ability to align community support, to make those connections from the Rotary Club to the Chamber to parent groups and teachers. Nor will they be satisfied that you are data-driven, including when that data tells you classroom size is an indicator of student success. But in the end, we all know this is entirely about the results produced. Your legacy will be about turning around our culture problem, finding our academic performance flaws, and fixing them, and creating an education plan for one of the most complicated places Midland's next leader of schools faces, an awesome opportunity, if not the most complicated. Midland's next leader of schools faces an awesome opportunity for education in the state. Midland is not an easy place when it comes to education and academic success. If it was, our paths likely would never have crossed. But here we are. Dr. Ramsey, we are about to hand you the keys to our educational kingdom. It is an awesome responsibility. Let me rephrase that. It is an awesome opportunity. I really believe that, and if you show you're capable where others have fallen short, this community will be willing to shower you and the district with the type of support that only Midland can. Column by Stuart Doreen. Let's show our support for MISD's next leader. Typically, I would not say go out of your way to take in school governance during your lunch hour. However, Friday's meeting of the Midland ISD School Board will not be a typical meeting. During this meeting, inside the auditorium of the Bowie Fine Arts Academy, board members will approve the contract and make official the hiring of the next superintendent, Angelica Ramsey. And yes, she will be present for the meeting. I hope the community will come out and show its support for Dr. Ramsey, but not for the reason you think. Of course, I am on the record as thinking this leader of educators is the real deal. I'm not the only one. The leaders of this community's preeminent education support site, MISD Homework, have stated their optimism for Ramsey. People, especially those with doubts, need to meet this woman and give her a chance to explain why education can succeed in Midland and why now is the time. My expectation is you will like what you hear and you will understand why this woman is refreshingly different.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 4th. Former New Mexico State Senator Bill Lee, a longtime rancher and Lovington, New Mexico resident, passed away on January 26th. Viewing was held on Monday, February 1st, at Kirby Ratliff Funeral Home in Lovington, New Mexico. Graveside services were held Tuesday, February 2nd, at the Lovington Cemetery. Pastors officiating were Daryl Winter and David Matkins. Bill Lane Lee was born November 19, 1933, to R.D. and Leora Culp Lee in Lovington, New Mexico. He was the paternal grandson of Dick and Viola Lee and maternal grandson of Baxter and Julia Culp. He was married to the love of his life, Pat Lee, who preceded him in death. They have three children, a son, Lane Lee of Las Vegas, Nevada, a son and son-in-law, Randy Lee and Gabriel Romero of Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, a daughter and son-in-law, Missy and Bobby Bells, and one granddaughter, Carson Bells, of Lovington. David Manuel Lewis passed away in the late evening on January 20th. A visitation will be held at Ellis Funeral Home in Midland on Thursday, February 4th, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. A graveside service will be held at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland on February 5th at 3 p.m. David was born on May 3rd, 1954, in Casa Grande, Arizona, to David Lewis and Emily Phelps Wilson. David is preceded in death by his mother, Emily Wilson, his father, David Lewis, his sisters, Jenny Gardner and Tammy Jenkins, his niece, Jamie Moore, and by his stepfather, Bobby Wilson. He is survived by his daughter, Tracy Lewis, his son, Michael Lewis, and wife, Jasmine, as well as many grandchildren. He is also survived by his sisters, Mary Howell, Mae Moore, Lisa Lewis Driscoll, Dana White, and Laura Lewis Hall, brothers Mark Wilson, Tommy Wilson, and Terry Wilson. Arrangements are entrusted to Ellis Funeral Home in Midland. Catherine Joyce Williamson was peacefully called home to walk with the Lord on January 11th. Kathy was born Catherine Joyce Hicks to Roy and Bessie Hicks in Poyen, Arkansas, on August 20th, 1945. After high school, she moved to Coleman, Texas, where she met and soon married James Williamson. She traveled the country with James and later planted her roots in Midland, Texas. She is preceded in death by her husband, James Williamson, her parents, Roy and Bessie Hicks, her brother, John Hicks, and sisters, Juanita Hicks, Wilma Mills, and Coralie Harris. Kathy is survived by her two children, Susan Hilliard and David Williamson. She is also survived by several grandchildren, as well as her sisters-in-law, Geraldine Cagle and Norma Sweek, and many nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, Kathy asked that a donation be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in her honor. Arrangements were under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Marvin Jackson Jr. passed away January 28th. Marvin was born September 2nd, 1965, in Lorain, Texas. Visitation will be held Friday, February 5th, from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m., at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service will be held Saturday, February 6th at 2 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel. He is preceded in death by his parents, Marvin Jackson Sr. and Daisy McCann, sister Deborah, and brother Jesslyn. Survivors include his daughter, Turkisha Sadie Joiners, sisters Patricia, Christina, Emma, Jessica, Dolores, Tammy, Teresa, as well as brothers Tommy, Anthony, Gary, Stacy, Zachary, and Ty. Her arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Teresa Sam Guyton, also known as Teresa, Mama, and Baba, went home to be with the Lord on Saturday, January 30th, after battling COVID. A rosary will be held on Thursday, February 4th at 7 p.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church. A celebration of life mass will be at 1 p.m. on Friday, February 5th at St. Anne's Catholic Church in Midland, with burial following at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Teresa Marie Stanislawski was born in Johnson City, New York in 1937 to Julia and Louis Stanislawski. After graduating from high school in Corning, she attended Syracuse University. Sam is preceded in death by her granddaughter, Elizabeth Ann Burbank, Steve Guyton, and Frank Brownson. In lieu of flowers, Memorial donations may be made to the Battered Women's Center at www.safeplacenow.com. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Rosa Elvia Vitella, age 71 of Midland, passed away Friday, January 29th. Viewing will be Friday, February 5th from 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. and a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Friday evening at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Saturday, February 6th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. She is survived by two sons, Samuel Lewis Valenzuela and Mark Anthony Valenzuela, one daughter, Viola Vitella Valenzuela, nine grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. Steve Lemuel Holifield Sr., age 83, of Laurel, Mississippi, passed away on January 31st. The family will receive guests from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 4th, at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, February 5th, at Stonegate Fellowship, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Survivors include a wife, Brenda, daughter, Lisa Holifield, and grandchildren, Landry Holifield, Lindsay Venerable, Laramie Holifield, and Lemuel Holifield. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Thursday, February 4th, 2021. Front page. Stop the spread. Wear a mask. Protect yourself and others against COVID-19. OHS Permian reveal all state musicians. By Ruth Campbell, RCAMPBELL@OAOA.com. Despite this year of strangeness, Odessa and Permian high schools each had students achieve the coveted honor of all state musician. They included Caitlin Fitzgerald, Paige Byford, and Justice Davis from the OHS Chorale, and Aiden Caballero, Sean Price, Alex Lozano, and Dylan Martin from Permian. Students and directors assembled in the Permian Band Hall for photos and interviews Wednesday morning. Although there is no Texas Music Educators Association convention and concert this year in San Antonio, Director of Fine Arts Aaron Hawley said they are excited about the students' accomplishments. Once you're an All-Stater, lots of the time it's like a badge of honor. You're forever a Texas All-Stater. Even as we hire people to an interview, they make it known that they were in All-State because it's such a rare accomplishment. They will be All-Staters for the rest of their lives, Hawley said. Hawley said about 50,000 students start the process, and PHS band director Jeffrey Whitaker said about 3.7% make it to an all-state ensemble. Davis, a 15-year-old ninth grader at OHS, said he was proud of himself for making all-state because he competed against juniors and seniors. Davis said he has always enjoyed singing and has been doing it since he was in sixth grade. Byford, a 16-year-old sophomore, said she was glad all her hard work paid off. She added that she got help from her mother, who is her voice teacher. Fitzgerald, a 16-year-old sophomore, said she was proud of herself for working so hard. "I was really surprised, but I was just very proud of myself," Fitzgerald added. Lozano, an 18-year-old senior who plays bass trombone, said this is the first time he has made Allstate. I was really shocked, and I honestly couldn't believe it. My first instinct was to run to my parents and tell them how excited I was, Lozano said. He added that he texted all his friends. I didn't think I was going to make it, but here we are, Lozano said. His future plans include attending University of Texas Permian Basin to become a music teacher. He said he didn't really switch up his regular practice routine for this year's region auditions. I just kind of went through the motions a little bit, and then towards the end, when I started getting a little more anxiety about it, I started practicing more and more, and I switched up my routine a lot, and it really paid off in the end for me, I would say, Lozano said. Price, a 14-year-old ninth grader, plays the French horn at PHS. He would like to attend West Texas A&M University and pursue a career in music. I thought it was pretty cool, Price said. I just worked really hard and just practiced a lot because my mom actually also made it as a freshman, so I have that pressure on me. Other family members have earned the recognition as well. People told him there was no pressure, but I guess I was putting the pressure on myself to do it, Price said. Martin, a 17-year-old senior saxophone player, is the principal in the PHS band. He made Allstate last year, too. Making it again, it kind of meant everything to me, Martin said. It was a hard time because of coronavirus and a lot of things that were... It was a hard time because of coronavirus and a lot of things were taken away this year. Still making Allstate again, especially my senior year, because I won't get another chance to, it meant a lot to me. Caballero, a 17-year-old junior percussionist, said this is the first year he has made Allstate. I couldn't believe it when I saw the results. I thought it was fake, honestly. I was like, there's no way. They're messing with me. I looked at all three papers, and it's like, I made it, Caballero said. He added that it has sunk in a little bit, but I still can't believe it. Caballero said he practiced more than in previous years. Now I practice like 2 or 3 hours a day, he added. Whitaker noted that the auditions were different this year and prompted the students to put in more time. Our students didn't go to an audition live. They had to submit their recordings, and therefore they had to hear it before they submitted it. When I saw as a result of that, what I saw as a result of that is that they practiced more. They knew what their audition was going to be, and they were not satisfied. So it resulted in kids practicing more, and what a good situation to come out of that, Whitaker said. OHS Director of Choirs Ginger Story said she is super excited for her students' achievements, especially in a year that has been anything but normal. They've done a great job of getting prepared for the competition. I'm super excited about the fact that I've got a freshman and 2 sophomores in this position, so this gives them several more years to make the choir again, and hopefully the next time they'll be able to have a clinic and concert for them, Story said. She added that it shows the students have a good work ethic and they made it through the weirdness of everything. We told them you're going to get to record yourself, and so this should give those of you that have a little bit more of that stage fright less of that, because you're going to be by yourself in a room with a recording device and going from there, Story said. But some of them said they found that a little bit more intimidating to do that. They had 3 different songs that they were singing from, so if they messed up 1 song, they couldn't go back and just fix that 1 song. They had to go back and do the whole thing over. That made it a little bit tougher, but we've really pressed them on rehearsing on their own. If there was anything that being virtual promoted, that was individual practice, because they weren't able to do that with us, especially at the very beginning. They had to do it at home and on their own, so I think that was probably a positive thing to come from this situation for them. Photo by Jacob Ford, Odessa American. Ector County Independent School District's 7 students, chosen for Texas All-State, stand for a portrait Wednesday in the Permian Band Hall. Getting the job done. Photo by Jacob Ford, Odessa American. City of Odessa's Assistant City Manager, Philip Urrutia, poses for a photo Monday at Ratliff Stadium. Urrutia has spearheaded the city's response to COVID-19 this past year. City worker helps in many ways by Federico Martinez, F-M-A-R-T-I-N-E-Z at OAOA.com. He wasn't even old enough to rent a car when he began working for the city of Odessa. 13 years later, Phil Urrutia, Odessa's assistant city manager, can not only rent a car, he oversees 9 departments, including the office responsible for the city's fleet of vehicles. For the past year, Urrutia's biggest task has been to spearhead the city's response to COVID-19. Those efforts have included collaborating with local health officials and city department staff to educate the public about the deadly virus, direct them to resources, and help provide COVID-19 testing and vaccinations. With COVID, he has taken on a real sense of responsibility to help the community, said City Manager Michael Morero, who promoted Urrutia to Assistant City Manager 2 years ago. His efforts speak to the commitment that the city and council has. Urrutia has been instrumental in numerous efforts, including helping to establish a food bank and housing assistance programs to help residents adversely affected by the coronavirus, Marrero said. He also developed collaborations with local hospitals and persuaded the city to use CARES funds to create mobile testing sites at no charge to residents and to help purchase laptops for local students who were forced to attend school virtually. He also worked with multiple city departments, including law enforcement and fire rescue, to help Medical Center Hospital with their current mass vaccination efforts at Ratliff Stadium. Urrutia isn't just someone who barks orders and sits back and watches others do the work, Marrero and several city employees said. When the vaccinations began last week, Urrutia was at the stadium every day to make sure city employees had everything they needed, whether it was tissue paper, notepads and pens, or bottles of water, said Devin Sanchez, the city's director of communications. Urrutia, who prefers to shun the spotlight, is quick to credit the tireless efforts of city staff and their willingness to work together for the city's often praised response to the COVID pandemic. My grandparents and their parents picked cotton in the fields, Urrutia said. I came from a family of blue-collar workers who all had a strong work ethic. I'm going back to what I learned growing up. I'm not above any job. If something needs to be done, I'm going to do it. It's that kind of attitude that has earned Urrutia the respect of his peers, Marrero said. He's a very humble guy. He has a great level of commitment to the organization and the community, and he's well regarded for his professionalism and passion. We're truly fortunate to have him in the city. A native of Lubbock, Urrutia earned a bachelor's degree in political science and sociology from Texas Tech University. He later received a master's degree in public administration and is a certified public manager and emergency management professional. I was hired right out of college by the city, now 35-year-old Urrutia said. I was hired as a supervisor for municipal court. During the next decade, he worked in several other city departments, including planning and as director of purchasing and fleet. I owe my position to former city manager Richard Morton, who took a chance and hired me, Urrutia said. Richard Morton and Michael Marrero both took me under their wing and have given me a chance to prove myself. Former Odessan helps design new White House logo. Courtesy photo, the new White House logo that former Odessan John Mata helped design that is now in use. By Michael Bauer, MBAUER at OAOA.com. Throughout his years as a freelance illustrator and graphic designer, former Odessan John Mata has seen his works featured in various publications, viewed by countless people all over. His latest illustration, though, ranks at the top for him. This month, Mata, who now lives in Dallas, helped illustrate the new White House logo that is now in use by the Biden administration. "I cannot believe where art has taken me," Mata said. "It's taken me around the world, doing stuff that is seen by millions of people. It all started in a small Texas town where I was doodling all the time. I can't thank my upper hand enough to encourage me to do what I like to do for a living." Mata is a 1999 graduate of Odessa High School and a 2003 graduate of UTPB. He lived in Odessa until 2008 after moving to Dallas. Due to a non-disclosure agreement, Mata isn't allowed to speak too much on the subject of his White House logo. But he can safely say the whole process wasn't a contest. "It was a conscious decision," Mata said. "It wasn't like I did a contest or anything like that." The new logo, which is subtly refreshed from the Trump administration, depicts the White House facade with architectural details, such as the columns and windows in white on a navy blue background. Mata worked alongside creative agency Wide Eye to help design the logo, along with creative director Karana Magwood. The logo can be seen on the White House website, www.whitehouse.gov. The changes went into effect on Inauguration Day, 2 weeks ago. Shortly after seeing the changes, Mata was receiving calls from friends and colleagues left and right. "They were extremely proud, and I was getting calls from the college," Mata said. "If I can encourage anyone to go into design by being a mentor for them, then that would be awesome because people do that for me. Now I can use a little bit of that and be like, hey, maybe you're the next person to do this or go further than me and beyond." For Mata, art was a big part of him growing up and continues to be to this day. He's thankful for all the help and encouragement his mentors at Odessa High and UTPB gave him. "I was in AP art classes in high school," Mata said. "My teachers really encouraged me to pursue art, and when I got into college, I wasn't sure about what I was going to be, but I was thankful that my advisors guided me to be an art major, and I'm glad because I can't see myself doing anything else." While Mata has a day job, he's able to spend the weekends working with clients on illustrations and graphic designs. His portfolio includes doing illustrations for National Public Radio, ESPN, as well as Herb Lester Associates, which makes city guides around the world and is based in London. "NPR hired me to do a cover for their donor gifts," Mata said. "I did some holiday cards for them as well. It's just random clients." His work for ESPN included an illustration to try and recruit LeBron James to join the Mavericks. "That was a fun little side project," Mata said. "I drew a billboard that said, 'LeBron, come to Dallas. We'll give you season tickets to the Cowboys.' I feel like my clients are so random, and that's why even getting this one for the White House was crazy. With each different client come different tasks for Mata to get it just right. It's hard to say, because each one presents its own challenges and its own unique touches that are required, Mata said. He continues to work in graphic design, but says he's gradually shifted towards doing more illustrations. I guess as a graphic designer, sometimes you feel like you can't live in both worlds, which is not 100% true, Mata said. Sometimes I feel like as a graphic designer, it feels like you're just doing logos and layouts and stuff like that. Whereas as an illustrator, you can say that you're illustrating for a children's book or I'm making drawings for this. I feel like for me, I was just doing graphic design until I got the opportunity to do an illustration for someone. Then, all of a sudden, I liked both worlds. I like doing layouts and logos, but I also like doing illustrations as well. What he loves the most about doing illustrations is being able to get paid to do what he loves. I know that sounds silly, but at the end of the day, I feel like I'm getting paid to mess around and draw all day, Mata said. Sometimes it's stressful, but at the same time, it feels like it beats any other job that I've had where you don't get to do things like that and make something out of nothing. 370 days. For 370 days, the city has fought a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American to enforce the state law that guarantees the public's right to see basic police records. Through January 6th, the city has spent $112,138.47 of taxpayers' dollars to fight releasing information on crime in Odessa. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County numbers are not updated daily. ECISD daily cases, 12 students, 6 staff. U.S. cases, 26,277,125 total confirmed, and 445,264 deaths. Find out more at dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. COVID-19 vaccines. Medical Center Hospital will be administering Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine at the drive-through clinic at Ratliff Stadium, South Main Entrance. The clinic will start at 9 a.m. and gates close at 2 p.m. today and tentatively open on Friday only if vaccines remain. Clinic is for Phase 1A, frontline workers, and Phase 1B, most at risk and for ages 65 and older. Online registration requested for quicker on-site processing. For those that are not able to register online, will be rerouted to a waiting area to register before vaccination. Wear short-sleeve clothing, easy to access arm. Bring a valid driver's license or other photo ID. To pre-register or for more information, visit mchodessa.com. For those looking for a way to help, email volunteers@odessa-tx.gov. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 520 East 6th Street. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 520 East 6th Street, is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. The vaccine is free of charge while supplies last. Please check on vaccine availability. For more information, call 432-582-8549 or visit tinyurl.com/Y3JQHZ89. Walgreens has limited COVID-19 vaccine available in select areas. For eligibility requirements or more information, visit tinyurl.com/26PLSIK2. HEB pharmacies are prepared to receive new allotments of COVID-19 vaccine at any time from the state of Texas. Once they have vaccine, eligible customers can sign up using the scheduler to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. To sign up, updates, or information, visit vaccine.heb.com. CVS stores are administering the COVID-19 vaccine by appointment only in select stores based on local eligibility guidelines. For updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y508QJE4. Walmart and Sam's Club pharmacies are administering the COVID-19 vaccine based on state and federal eligibility guidelines in select areas. For updates, visit tinyurl.com/Y5K95KZN. From Staff Reports. Closing prices posted $52.17. Futures $55.69. Natural gas $2.789. Benchmark U.S. rose 93 cents to $55.69 per barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Pairs for pairs. www.theunitedfamily.com. On Tuesday, the United Family donated 1,000 pairs of socks to the Salvation Army organizations in the Permian Basin. This is the second year the United Family has helped make this donation of 500 pairs of socks to the Salvation Army in Midland and 500 more to the Salvation Army of Odessa. The donation stems from a program called PAIRS, P-E-A-R-S, for PAIRS, P-A-I-R-S. From October to December of 2020, a portion of the proceeds from the purchase of Rainier Fruit pairs went to purchasing socks to donate to organizations that support the homeless community. For some, a new pair of socks can make a world of difference, Joseph Bunting, Produce Business Director for the United Family, said. That's why we are so grateful to once again partner with Rainier Fruits to do this program. We are also thankful to our guests for participating and helping us raise the funds for the socks. Thanks to United Family guests and Rainier Fruit, a total of 5,000 pairs of socks will be donated to charitable organizations across the state of Texas. The following organizations will receive socks: Salvation Army of Amarillo, Salvation Army of Midland / Salvation Army of Odessa, Salvation Army of Lubbock, Salvation Army of Abilene, and Faith Mission of Wichita Falls.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.